You're listening to the Drummers Education Connection Podcast. Interviews with the greatest drummers in the business and roundtable discussions with industry leaders and teachers from around the globe to help provide performance, insight, and inspiration.
I know that drum fill. Everybody, welcome to Drummers Education Connection. Thank you so much for tuning in today. We got a great guest today, Sean Duncan from LA Gun. Sean, how are you?
I'm good. How are you, man? Y'all, how are all you, actually?
We're all here rocking out with you. Hey, guys, so as usual, what we like to do here at the beginning of DEC is take care of a little bit of business. We want to thank you guys for watching and tuning in every week and then also watching the back episodes on YouTube. If you want to be a contributor to the show, you can go to Patreon, help us keep the lights on. All that ever does is just help pay for, like, the website hosting and stuff like that. Helps us out with DEC Day and all the stuff that we do here for drum education. And, you know, that's kind of our thing. We also like to do a thing called Good Things, where we go around and talk about the good stuff that we got going on in drumming, outside of drumming, with each one of us, just a little short snidbit. And since we have a guest host today from Boise, Idaho, the great Fred Rock Fisher. What the heck is going on in your life today that is great, buddy? Talk to us.
Well, moments before I got on, I had to fix my wife's flat tire.
Uh-oh. Perfect. <Awesome. laughs>
So I wear a lot of hats, of course. So I think you were out of the room, Bart, but I was telling this quick story, and Rick said I should tell the funny story rather than a good things.
Okay.
So we were talking, and I don't know what sparked this, but I was talking about when I was doing shows when I was younger, my crash cymbals in front of me were so high I could barely touch them with my fingertips. They were way up there. So I just these big, huge movements, and I used to leap out of my seat and kick them. One particular show, my shoelace got snagged around the wing nut, and so I just came crashing. That was, of course, a showstopper. And so then I had to reevaluate how my shoelaces were tucked into my shoes so that wouldn't happen again. But, you know, as you get older and a little heavier, the thought of leaping out of my seat and kicking a cymbal became less and less. So I don't do that anymore. But
I love those moments that we all have where you go, man, Spinal Tap wishes they would have.
Oh, yeah.
That.
Yeah.
It's just,
yeah.
Spinal Tap is like, why didn't we do that? Chip, what about you, buddy? What's going on with you, man?
I love how he evaluated the shoelaces and not the kicking of the cymbals.
Show business, Chip.
I'm doing good, man. My good thing isn't really drum related. It's about health. I'm walking every day with my friend Carl in the morning. So we're doing the walk, and that's a healthy thing for me to do, and I'm excited about that.
Awesome.
Nice. How about you, Rick?
I tell you what, man, I'm all camera crazy here in the studio trying to offer better drum lessons to my students. So I've got all kinds of cameras. I've got 5 cameras going here in the studio. That's a student kit. And so now I'm making real, that's a remote camera. So I'm making videos, drum videos of play-alongs for my students and recording their lessons for them. And right, so technology,
wow, that's cool.
Happening, man.
That's bitching, dude.
Yeah. That studio is awesome.
Thanks, man. Thanks,
no doubt.
Oh, and then my brother-in-law, Gene, got back from tour last night. Gene Hoagland, he got back Sunday night, and we all got to a family get-together for a dinner out. And he's been out with Death to All and Death Clock and various other bands almost all year. So it's nice.
You know, every picture I saw of Gene, he's wearing your shirt. Did you get him a new one?
He's got three, so.
Okay.
You can smell them through the phone or anything, right? Well, we just got back from Wisconsin, and the band's Locking and Rocking. We're working all the time, so I got a couple weeks off in July, which is nice. My side project, The Ruins, this is just by happenstance that this happened. It wasn't meant to be this way. Sean, your brother Jeff, just recorded a guitar solo for me on a song called Bone on Bone. And then I told him, I was like, hey, man, your brother's going to be on my podcast on Tuesday. He goes, yeah, I saw that. I didn't know it was yours. So it's just kind of weird happenstance that that happened. So I'm excited about that. All things are good here on this front. Lots of drum students, lots of work. Sean, what about you? You're in LA Guns. We're going to interview you today, talking about your career and your life and music. But what good things you got going on, bud?
Well, I just got back about a week ago from Vegas, ironically enough, recording some stuff for my brother Jeff.
Right on.
And who you just talked to, who just did that lead for you. And I was recording four songs for him for a project that he has coming up that I can't say too much about yet. But that was a lot of fun. And I hadn't seen him in a while because we had both been on tour. I think the last time I saw him was last time LA Guns played in Vegas, which was in December of last year, I want to say. So it was good to see him. We got to hang out and had dinner and played music like we've been doing since we were five.
Well, that's awesome, man. You know what? I think that's a great segue into this whole thing. I mean, because you and your brothers have been playing music since you were five, and you were in bands together and stuff. Why don't you tell us a little bit about this whole music journey started, and especially kind of since it's a family affair for you guys. How did this whole thing, how did it get started for you, man?
Well, it kind of all started from our father. My dad was a songwriter, and he had, matter of fact, one of the songs he wrote, if you're a sports fan, you know it, and it's got the hand clap that goes blah 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 blah. Let's go, blah blah. Okay.
No way. So,
yeah, he wrote that. Wow. It's funny. Every time I watch a game on TV, I hear it five or six times, and I just kind of have to grin. You know.
That's so cool, dude.
I know, right? So. We were around music our whole life. He did some arranging for Bones Howe over at Bell Records for a while for stuff for the Fifth Dimension, the Association. He played with Jim Messina. So we grew up in music, and I was literally, I'm sure you guys can relate, I was dragging my mom's Tupperware and pots, pans, Folgers cans with lids, whatever, to beat on when I was, you know, when I could, when I don't even remember starting doing it. Let's just put it that way. And then my brother Jeff picked up my dad's guitar when he was really young. There's a photo somewhere of me and Jeff and my youngest brother, Matt. And I have these two big pieces of wood and I'm hitting a trash can, and Jeff has a guitar and Matt's got some sort of a instrument, and we're like, we must have been, you know, I might have been seven, so that would make Jeff five and Matt three. And on the back, my mom had wrote it's the beginning. That's all it said in the back of it in her handwriting, which is really that's how it started. So over the years we just always played. And then I ended up in junior high school, my brother Jeff got into this band called the Termites, and their drummer got grounded and couldn't play. And so he goes, hey, my brother plays drums. And that was the first time I ever got behind a drum set for more than like a couple hours. And I went in there, and for some reason I could do it. And I ended up playing with them. We did some talent shows and had some fun, and that morphed over the years into the band Odin, mm-hmm. which was mine and Jeff's band. And then that, we were in the decline of the Western civilization. We were more infamous than famous. And, but it's funny because still to this day sign tons of Odin stuff when I'm on the road. It's really, it became this kind of mysterious thing, I guess. And the movie kind of immortalized it, I guess you could say. Right, and then after, what's that?
I said, right on.
Yeah, it was fun. And but that was, you know, that was the beginning of from a professional standpoint, where you're making records and videos and touring and playing live and constantly. And then after that, me and Jeff have always had bands throughout the years. We had a band called DC4, which we had with Matt. Well, we have with Matt, our youngest brother, and Rowan Robertson plays guitar on that with us. And we did 5 albums. And then I went and did some touring about 3 or 4 years with Bullet Boys. Mm-hmm. And now I'm with LA Guns. And there was a bunch of other recording stuff in between, and live shows and careers and, you know, various things outside of music that I've been doing throughout my life.
That's fantastic. Now, the Odin thing, from what I kind of remember, I mean, you guys on the Strip, that was the band. I mean, at Gazzari's, yeah. and the Whiskey and the Roxy and stuff like that. How long did that go on for? And do you guys ever, like, reunite that thing? Because it is kind of this underground thing. It's yeah.
Yeah, it did. It created a life of its own. We have done reunion shows here and there throughout the years. We usually play the Whiskey when we do it. Mm-hmm. We haven't done one since, I think it was 18 or 19, 2019, I want to say. There was talk of us doing one this year, but all of our schedules collided and it wasn't going to happen. So, Jeff's been really busy with Armored Saint, and then I'm getting ready to go out right now. At the end of the month with Guns again. So, you know, getting our schedules to all work together and having the right thing, and people living in different states. Randy lives in Nashville, Jeff lives in Vegas, and me and Aaron are out here in California. But at least when we do it, it's the original band. So it's a lot of fun.
It is all the original members when you do it. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. We won't do it unless it is.
That's cool.
What era was Odin playing in the LA scene?
Like what was that? What year?
Yeah,
well, we started pretty early, and I'm going to say our earlier shows were 83, 82, 83.
Yeah.
And then our biggest show, the show that launched us, Chris Holmes was a very good friend of us. He used to come down to our rehearsal studio all the time, and he really liked the band. And we had a pretty good draw. And he got us a gig at the Troubadour opening for Wasp as direct support. And it was a very a highly publicized show, because it was like benefiting the blood drive. And
oh, I remember that with the blood mobile.
Yeah. They had that out there.
I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it kind of turned us into a headliner after that in for the Troubadour and the Roxy and Whiskey. And from there on, it just kind of, you know, we opened up a few more pretty big shows. We opened up for Malice and a lot of bands. I can't even remember all the bands, but it didn't take us long, within a year. So I'm going to say about 80, by 84, we were a full-blown headliner and started recording our second EP, which was Don't Take No for an Answer. And when that came out, we never looked back. We were headlining. And when we would play in L.A. as an opener, it was usually like we played the Palladium with Dawkins. And then we shared the stage. We did co-billing, co-headlining with Leatherwolf at the Palace once, and then also with Racer X, which was a badass band, you know, monsters. But that was kind of how the scene was. The scene was very happening, and it was a lot of fun, and we took full advantage of it.
But we're a G-rated show, so we can't hear all those.
Yeah.
So really, you're right there with in the scene as all of the metal bands, hair metal and all that stuff was just kind of evolving. So did you see the, you know, Motley Crue come up and Guns N' Roses, all these bands come up from nothing, right?
Yeah, I saw I saw Motley Crue had a residency at the Whiskey on Wednesday nights. I went to a few of those shows. Me and my brother, the first time I went, it was only about 100 people there. And then they just exploded and it just kept getting bigger and bigger. And then like Mickey Ratt opened for them, Dante Fox was turned into Great White. I mean, it was literally the beginning of all of that. And we saw Ratt grow. We saw again, Great White. It was just the plethora of people come of bands at that period of time on the strip was gigantic. It was just, I can't even explain it. And the scene, and then, you know, you could, I have a flyer somewhere of us playing at the Roxy with Malice and, I think Lizzie Borden. And the next night was Savage Grace and Slayer. And it's that's how it was. You just had everybody was playing somewhere. There wasn't a dead night. It was like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. They were all, you know, the strip was alive. You could drive down there. And I explained this to somebody the other day, those that don't know. But the Sunset, the hot spot of the strip was really only about three and a half blocks. It was from the Central, which is the Viper Room, up to Gazzari's. So it was, but it was so congested and people handing out flyers and girls and going in and out of clubs and the Rainbow. And, I mean, it was just great.
So the competition just had to be so, so fierce. It just had to be intense. And that's just people in bands. I'm sure everybody was moving to LA who wanted to be a musician to try to make it. And so what was it with the bands that popped? The ones that really, that we know of today, I know they weren't better.
No, I think it has a lot, you know, somebody explained making it in music as 90% luck and 10% talent. And I kind of, as I think about that, as I've gotten older over the years, there's a lot of truth to that, because you have to have, you could get signed. That's, you know, you get a record deal. Great. But everybody has to be on your team and everybody has to be working for you, from your management to your agent, to your PR people, to your record label. They all have to, like, everything has to, it's a machine and it all has to be running top notch to push it over the edge, to give you the exposure and give you the money it takes to be out there in front of people. Yeah. So that, you know, some of that is luck and songs, man. A lot of people just didn't have songs. You could be the most talented musician in the world, but if you can't play a song, you're not going to reach the kind of people, the audience that's going to, you know, propel you forward. So there's a lot of things involved in it.
Yeah.
But but the one thing that did happen, though, when as more and more talent started coming into L.A., the bands did get better. And for the most part, it was the labels that kind of screwed up music, because they started putting together bands with who's ever the prettiest as opposed to whoever could play. Right. And having songwriters write their songs. And it just kind of cheesed into garbage.
Yeah.
And then came grunge, which kicked its ass because it was real. And, you know, that's what Motley Crue and Ratt and all those bands were when they started too. It was real. It wasn't fake. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
If you look back in time, that's usually, if there's a wave of music, it's because somebody very real comes out and speaks.
That had to be a pretty exciting time to witness all of that and be a part of all of that as it was happening, I would imagine, anyway.
It was really, like, when I look back on it, I realize how lucky we were to be in that position at the time, and the memories are phenomenal.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And the opportunity to play with so many good people and just the enormity of what was going on at the time. It's really, it was a gift. And when you look back at it, I still smile.
You're thankful for it. That shows.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very cool. When you were, you talked about playing with Wasp, correct me if I'm wrong. Phil Lewis was the drummer at that time. Was he the drummer at that time?
No, not Phil, Riley, but it wasn't Riley. It was their original drummer that was in Wasp at the time. I'm forgetting his name right now, and I don't know why. Tony was his first name.
Okay.
It was before they got signed to Capitol. So they were still up and coming, but exploding.
Yeah.
That's it. Great drummer, by the way. He was phenomenal. He played on the first album, All That Soon. So that's who was in the band at the time.
Okay. But then now Phil Lewis, wasn't he the original drummer for LA Guns, right?
No, it's Steve Riley was.
Okay, got it. That's why I said, correct me if I'm wrong. Steve Riley was the.
Yeah.
Okay. Got it.
And then he got the Wasp gig.
That's what it was.
They got him from Wasp, and then Guns got him from Wasp. After Wasp, he went to LA Guns.
Okay. Great. Yeah. Now from Odin, you said you went, where did you go after Odin went away? When that kind of had run its course, what did you do after that?
Music. Yeah. Well, my brother went in and joined Armored Saint, and then I played in a band for a little bit, Pereira, a few other bands, another band that I really enjoyed, which was called Outlandless the Soul, which was like Jay Giles type of meets the Black Crowes type of a thing.
Oh, cool.
It was a lot of fun. And that band was, I really enjoyed that band. And then after that, I kind of just did some recording, and me and Jeff had a band again called Bird of Prey that turned into DC4. And over the years, we've done so much stuff. I just consider it as like one giant morph into another project that me and my brother do. And then so that's what we did. That's what I was doing then.
That's really cool. Then how did the LA Guns thing come about? And how long have you been in the band?
Social Distortion thing come about.
Social Disorder. Well, they all kind of came from the same thing. So here's where that came from. I was in Bullet Boys. And we did a tour with Gunzo, which was Tracy Guns and Rudy Sarzo's band. And we shared a tour bus. And on that bus, I would get up late at night, and Tracy would be up. Me and him would just talk a lot. And we developed a friendship. And also on that tour, opening was Killer Bee, who Anders Lerenblom is the guy who does all the songwriting for Social Disorder. So after the Bullet Boys tour, I got a call from Sweden, because Killer Bee was from Sweden, and it was Anders asking me if I was available to do a tour with them in the UK. And I said, yeah. So I went and did that. And then we became really, you know, obviously we were already friends, but we came a little bit closer. And then I went to Sweden, did an album with them. And we went to Israel. We did a few things. I did quite a few things with them, which is a lot of fun. And then every once in a while, I would just text Tracy and say, hey, bud, what's up? Blah, blah, blah. You know, kind of kept in contact with him. And then one day out of the blue, I got I think we did the Social Disorder record first. We did. We did the first one, because that was during COVID. And I recorded the album remotely, and Anders sent me all these songs, and they were really rough. They weren't to a click or anything. So you guys know that wasn't the easiest thing to record to.
Yeah.
it was funny because then he gives me this thing. He goes, "Oh, Tracy's going to play on this," and I'm like, "On what I sent you?" and he's like, "Yeah." And I go, "I thought that was like a demo for you or something." You know, I mean, I gave my best, but I just knew what I was working with at that time. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And it ended up coming out fine, which is great. And then he says Rudy Sarzo's going to play on it, and I'm like, okay. But he had this singer named Thomas Norton, who's just phenomenal. And anyway, that was that. And then right at the end of COVID, I got a text from Tracy, and he goes, "Hey, what are you doing this summer?" That's all it said. And I go, "Well, I can move stuff around. Why?" And he goes, "Let me get back to you." So like 2 days later, I get a call from LA Guns management, and he just kind of lays it all out in like a 10 second assault of information. And I'm like, 9 weeks, really? And it was a 9 week tour. It was LA Guns, Faster Pussycat, and Tom Kiefer. And so that's how I got in the band. I did that. And so that basically I've been in the band 3 years. Cool. And we've done a lot of tours and festivals and cruises and all the good stuff. And we're getting ready to go out right now at the end of the month with Kiefer. We're doing a bunch of shows with Tom too on this run.
Nice.
Do you sub in Tom Kiefer's band too? Do you play with that band?
No, not at all. Oh. No. That's Jared Pope, who's a phenomenal drummer. He's a great guy. We're very tight with all of them. It's like a family when we play together. We've done so many shows together. So yeah, but Jared plays drums for them, and he's phenomenal.
I think that what you know, one of the things that we talk about here on the show a lot is it's almost taken for granted that you can play. You know, when you get to a certain thing, it's like, okay, you're a drummer, but can you get along? Can you get up late at night and talk with a guitar player from another band on a tour bus? Can you get along on a tour bus? You know, all those things.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of what I'm hearing here, that everybody's just cool and you guys hang, right?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, I've got to the point in my life where I'm not going to hang around something that's making me miserable. You know what I mean? I don't care. It's really important that people get along and that there's no drama, and it's a really hard thing to find. But this band has been drama free for, you know, the entire time I've been in it, and it's been pretty stable, and everybody gets along. I knew Johnny and Ace prior to joining Guns from being in Hollywood and doing jams with them and whatnot out here. So and also Ace was on the in Faster Pussycat when I went out with Bullet Boys, so we already were cool with each other and friends and everything. So the only one I didn't know was Phil, and
really?
Yeah, that was the only one I never met Phil. I met him briefly outside of Gaslamp, literally about 6 months before I got asked to be in the band. I went to go see him at Gaslamp, and he was walking in the front when me and my wife were walking in, and I go, "Hey, Phil." He goes, "Hey, who are you here to see?" I go, "You." And it was just kind of funny because that's the only time I ever met Phil Lewis. And so I got to tell this because it's funny, is the first thing I did, I got a call from Ace and Johnny. They both reached out to me immediately. And I was like, okay, well, I know all you guys. And I go, but what about Phil? How's Phil? Right. I'm going to be honest. I have, you know, lead singer post-traumatic stress disorder. So that's always my question, man. How's the singer? And they're like, oh, he's the sweetest person in the world. I'm not just saying that because he's our boss, blah, blah, blah. And it's the truth. The guy has been an absolute gem to work with, and I really can't say enough good things about the guy. So it's a family, and it's nice.
That's awesome. Cool, man. Hey, I got to ask you, not to change the subject, but Tell us about your gear. What kind of drums are you playing? What kind of cymbal? I heard you're on Aquarian heads. Is that true?
Oh, yeah. I've been with Aquarian for probably 15 years.
Yeah. Can you tell us about your gear?
All of us are. That's great. That's great.
Yeah, I love them. Right now I'm using the Response 2 with the white dots on the batter tom heads and on my kick drum. And then I'm kind of bottom thing, right? And snare drum, I'm using the high impact on the top. And then the drums themselves are Pearl MMX all maple with the rings. And then cymbals are all Sabian. That's what I'm using as far as like the main things. And my sticks, I'm using Scorpion drumsticks right now. And they've been holding up really good. So I'm happy with those.
What on your tour kit, what size are your drums? What sizes are you playing? It looks like big drums in the picture.
Yeah, the bass drum is a 24 by 16. And the tom is a 12 or a 14 by 12. And then 16 by 16, 18 by 18, four songs.
Very cool. And do you geek out question time? I mean, are you, when you say you record a lot with your brother out in Vegas, do you take a kid out there with you and use that kid, or does he have a studio kit out there? Do you find using those size big drums in the studio work for your sound?
Yeah, the studio in Vegas that I use, is they have this beautiful set of Ludwig classic maples, and he has a 24 inch kick, 13 tom, and a 16 floor. I like the cool little punk rock setup, really. And then I bring my cymbals, and that's what I use, and it sounds great in there. It's a great room, I don't know. I can't really say enough about it. It's a lot of fun. There's another studio I use out in Chatsworth, and that has also a Ludwig Classic Maple, and that one's a Bonzo setup. It's a 26 by 14, 14, 16, 18 right. set. And that one's also monstrous. It sounds really good. It's a good room. It's funny because the room that drum is in now is a room that I recorded DC4's Atomic Highway album in before these people owned the room. And I went to go do this recording there, and I was like, oh my God, I've been here. And I walked in and I go, I know this place. And he goes, yeah, we took it over and blah, blah, blah. So yeah, but that's what I use there. And again, I use my own cymbals. Oh, my snare drum, which I use is the Pearl. Why am I forgetting what it's called now? Oh, it's a Stavecraft. The Pearl Stavecraft is what I've been using almost primarily. I love that drum live. It's a beast, and it cuts through everything. And there's just no messing around with it. So that's what I've been using for about a little over a year and a half now.
Is that a
what Sabian cymbals are you using?
Right now I have the hi-hats are, the top is an AAX medium. The bottom is a HH groove. Yep. Those are both, they're 15s. And then the crash on my left is a 18 inch AAX medium. The crash on my right is a 20 inch AAX medium. Crash in the back is a AA rock crash. And the ride is a 21 inch. Rock ride. And that's pretty much, occasionally I might use a 19 inch projection on the over the where the 18 is. It just depends on my mood, really.
Those are all cymbals that can take a beating.
What's that? I'm sorry.
Those are all cymbals that can take a beating.
They do, and I've never been one to be gentle, so. It's good for me to have cymbals that last, and Sabians have been really, really good at that. I break them, but nowhere near the rate of what I would normally go through cymbals. It's not even close.
Right on. Sean, when you were younger, did you ever take drum lessons?
You know, I was in marching band in high school, and that was pretty much the extent of any lessons I ever got. My father was in bands, and occasionally I'd sit behind the drummer's set, and he might show me something. But that, other than that, I've never had any sort of lessons. And sometimes when I reflect back, I'm like, I wouldn't mind. I've toyed at the idea of actually going and taking some stuff to learn a little bit about, like, swing has interested me lately. So that could be in the cards.
So
you never stop learning.
Right, you don't. And that's you know, so important for young drummers to realize that, you know. And we just did a show recently on why, as a pro, you should still study, you know, why you should, why you should listen to, have a mentor, have a drum teacher that can help you. Now, you mentioned swing. You're interested in swing music and jazz and stuff. What are your influences? You know, like, what are some of the, who are some of your influences, and what might be interesting you or influencing you in the way of swing and jazz?
Well, when I was, my primary influence is, like, if I really boiled it down, would be Bonham, Powell, Roger Taylor, Joey Kramer. I'm going to have to kind of stick with that group. And then Vinnie Appice was very important as I got older, and Steve Smith. I loved Steve Smith's drumming, and I was a big Journey fan. So it's kind of a combination of those guys. And then I think where I'm getting the whole, like, interest in swing and whatnot is probably, it probably talks to me from all those Steve Smith records I used to listen to, or watching him play on YouTube. You know, you can go down rabbit holes of drummers on YouTube all day long and learn a ton of stuff just off that, you know?
If you've watched him play through the Wilcoxon book, man, oh my God, he just,
is that crazy?
Oh man. He, and then he's, you know, yeah. What a phenomenal drummer. That's yeah. So, yeah.
Hey guys, we got a question from Jim Royal. Jim Royal said, good afternoon, gentlemen. Sean, what do you do for fun, hobbies, when you're not touring and gigging?
Oh, I use that back there. I'm in the pool a lot, there was a period of time where, after I had my son, and I went into movie location catering, and I catered for huge movies, videos. I cooked for everybody from Madonna to Tom Hanks. And so I like to cook and barbecue and stuff like that. So I do a lot of that at home, walking. I love to fish. So those types of things. I like being outside.
Cool.
Hey, do you like hot salsa?
Oh, the hotter the better.
Dude, that's okay. Check this out. This is my new thing. I started making salsa. About 2 years ago. And oh yeah. Dude, I gotta get you some of my salsa. I'll get you some of my salsa. We'll
absolutely.
Yeah.
I literally grow habaneros because I like habanero salsa so much.
Oh, dude, I'm growing habaneros and serranos and jalapenos. I just made a batch of salsa today for my wife's work is having this thing, and so yeah. So I
awesome.
Made a batch of salsa for her. So I made green and red salsa. That's awesome, dude.
The most challenging thing to cook?
The challenging thing to cook, usually it's just something that you'd never cooked before. I mean, I hate to say, you know, that sounds a little chicken to say, but to be honest with you, it's like when you say, okay, you've never made a beef Wellington. It's like, then you're like, okay, I'm going to try it. So the first time is always pretty challenging. I think slow cooking in the barbecue, like I have a green egg, and those things kind of are, you have to watch the temp on them and a little bit. Once you get it lined up, it's pretty good. But slow cooking, like brisket or something, because they all, it's natural meat, so sometimes it just doesn't want to cooperate. So it just depends.
Do you cook on the road? I had to ask. Sorry, I do. Step on.
Yeah, it's funny because sometimes we'll opt to stop at a campground as opposed to going to hotels. And it's mainly because it's just nice to be out in nature, really. And we'll go to the market and buy stuff. And I usually end up grilling, everything for everybody and make some everything from, garlic, thyme, potatoes, whatever I'm in the mood to do, really. And, but yes, I'd like to do it more. But it's not as easy sometimes when you're traveling. So
I had to ask, cause the band that I'm in, we hub out of Airbnbs. We try to get a central Airbnb and hub out of it. And that's what I do. That's my thing. We go to the store and I get stuff and I cook. I love to cook. So that's cool, man. That's awesome.
Well, that's how to secure your place in the bands, guys, by being the chef.
Right? Well, see, it's a secret. But you know what's odd is I know a lot of the drummers that cook, they're out there. Benali loved cooking. I believe Tempesta. There's a lot of them that cook, and I think it's because there is a certain rhythm to cooking and there's a certain creativity involved. So I think it's an outlet.
Yeah, maybe we should have a podcast for cooking drummers.
Yeah, you should.
I've over the last year got into smoking brisket and tri-tip, which I love doing. Sometimes you got to get up at 3 a.m. to get it going so that it's ready for later. Loving doing ribeyes on the charcoal grill. And, because all my friends could cook except for me. And so my wife gave me a hard time for so long about it. And now that I've started getting into it, I really, really do enjoy doing that. I love it.
It's fun. It's fun, and it occupies a busy brain. So, and I need that. I need that.
There's a place right over here by the house called Ranch 99 Market, and they have these Colby ribeyes. Right.
Oh, nice.
All this marbling, but they're like, and I love to cook ribeyes, but they're $70 a pop for these steaks. And I'm like, man, I don't want to buy a $70 steak and screw it up. So I'm going to do it, but I want to make sure I got, got my I's dotted, my T's crossed.
Right. No,
hey Sean, I was watching one of your other interviews that you were on a podcast, and you guys were talking about the guy that was interviewing you was asking about the drug scene, how drug use was prevalent in the 80s back then, and can you tell us a little bit about how you avoided that? Like, how did you not get involved with that and take a wrong turn?
Well, we all partook to a certain degree in various enhancements, but I usually enjoyed being around like my girlfriend and stuff more than that. If that, I was more into girls than I was into that. And I think that's kind of what kept me away from it. When I look back, cause I'm like, well, there was a lot of stuff going on when I was going to Big Bear with her or with a girl or whatever. So I think that kind of kept me away from going over the deep end on it. I've seen a lot of people, really go the wrong way and it physically hurting them to this day, they're paying for it, if they're alive. Yeah. But they always kind of scared me a little bit. When we grew up, my uncle was a heroin addict, and I saw the damage that it did to the family. And I think in my subconscious, it just kind of made me wary of keep my eyes open about what's right and wrong. My father was my father was never drank and was did absolutely no drugs whatsoever. So we didn't grow up in a household where it was acceptable to, like, you know, be like that, because it just it was abnormal to be to do that. You know what I'm saying? There was no normalcy in it. So I think that's what kept me about it. But it, as far as it being around, it was around and everywhere for years, from the Odin years to all the way well into the 90s. It just kept, really, once it got into the 90s, it started getting darker and darker because the drugs were heavier and heavier. So
yeah, there's
I got
really
lucky.
Bad stuff there now. Yeah, you got.
Oh, it's horrible. Yeah, it's dangerous now. It's not even I don't even see how, you know, I feel for kids. Let's just put it that way. It's, if you're going to experiment, you could die, and it's insane.
Yeah, it is sad, and I mean, especially like you said, nowadays everything is so heavy. You know,
yeah.
And like, you know, the rampant oxy use and stuff like that is just insane, you know.
Yeah, oxy and fentanyl, they're lacing stuff with fentanyl, and it's really dangerous, and it's like it was dangerous then, and why how we just made it more dangerous. It's insane. It's sad.
And you're not around it anymore. You don't see a lot of bands still out there using, do you?
No. Yeah. No. Guns doesn't do anything. We're pretty, like I said, this band's kind of like a family, and you know, there might be some, you know, beer and wine drinking. Maybe one night I'll open a bottle of Jack, and that's really about it. And there's not, it's not what it's about anymore. You know, it's about going out there being, I'm just happy to go out there and be able to play, yeah. You know, and do what I love to do. So you don't really need a lot of, you know, chemicals to get you through. Some people live on that stuff, but yeah. I'm glad I avoided it. And I certainly am not surrounded with it.
That's great.
Hey, Sean, what's more challenging for you, playing an open air stadium or the clubs? What do you prefer?
You know, it used to be playing outside used to be a challenge for me, and hearing everything and whatnot. But I, since I started using ears, that they're all pretty much the same now. And I really can't stress enough how much using in-ears, I use Ultimate Ears, how much they help me.
Yeah,
you know? It's night and day. I mean, I've been playing drums and loud music since I was, you know, in my teens, young teens, and you know, they've done some damage to my hearing over the years. And there were times where if the high end is too loud, it actually hurts. So when I got the in-ears, I could control that, and that can also, you know, tune my mix a little bit, and it's just made a night and day difference. So it doesn't matter anymore whether it's in a small club or whether it's in a big outdoor situation. It, as long as those are on and I have a monitor mix in it, I'm happy as hell.
Do you run your own monitor mix from where you're sitting?
No, I don't. You know, I'm not really a tech savvy type of a person. It's not, as you can see, I'm using my phone. it's just not something I really, you know, there's a part of me that just doesn't want to deal with all that plugging stuff in, and you know, you got your drums, that's enough stuff you got around you to deal with. And then you got all these cords and all this stuff. And it's just something that I might be being lazy, or it might intimidate me, but I've never really gotten into it. I did like, there's some places I've played where I could tap into the monitor via my phone and do some adjustments there, as long as I turn off all the guys. So I could, just as long as I just leave only my monitor on, which is really cool. There are apps for that. So I do like it when that's available. I also, the other thing, there's a give and take with ears, because the other thing that bothers me, the one thing that really bothers me is you don't really hear the crowd, and you don't really hear the thunder, if you will. So sometimes I'll get lucky and there'll be some room mics in the room. Some of the nicer venues have those, and they'll pump that in to your ears, and it's when that's there, it's just magic. It's like night and day. Sometimes I might pull one just a little bit out so I could hear a little bit of that too. So
very cool. What's your warm-up routine like? You getting ready to go on? What are you doing backstage to get warmed up?
Usually I get the sticks I'm going to use, which are basically extended 5Bs, and I flip them over and use the backs of them and do my, you know, paradiddles and double paradiddles and stuff like that. That's pretty much it. And stretching. I found that as I've gotten older, I need to stretch. I need to stretch my legs and my shoulders. So a lot of that's basically what I do is stretching, and I use the old, you know, the old baseball bat trick where, you know, you put the donut on the baseball. I just turn the sticks around so they're heavier. And then when I go out there, they're lighter when you flip around. But I also use a head stick in my left hand and a regular wood stick on my right hand live, because the stick I break is usually the one on my left. And I find the aheads last longer. A lot of people will ask me about balance on that and stuff. And it's like, you know what? I'm playing rock. I'm not playing jazz. I'm not playing, you know, stuff that's going to require an incredible amount of finesse. Mm-hmm. So it really doesn't make a difference to me. The way my brain works, it's just good for me to know that if that stick breaks, I got a couple more whacks on it before I got to toss it. Whereas a wood stick, sometimes you're just left with a stump. And you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's like out of the blue, it could be in the middle of a fill, and all of a sudden it's like, oh shit. And it kind of can throw you off a little bit. So that's what I use live. I don't use them in the recording studio because I don't like the way they sound on cymbals. But that's kind of what I use live.
Does that head stick a little tough on the snare head? Does it teed up the snare head a bit because the stick is kind of
I don't actually like they have a good bounce and they feel fine. I go on the road, I might go through a snare head every 4 or 5 days, depending on if we're headlining or if we're a support, depending on length of set. But you know, they don't tear anything up. They're pretty good. I just find them to be a little bit weighty. That's my only reason. And then again, I don't like the way the plastic sounds on cymbals. That's just me, thing maybe.
Yeah.
You know. So that's why I do that.
I think that's everybody has that thing they don't like. I tell my students, should I use wood tips or should I use nylon tips? I'm like, you, that's a decision you have to make, you know, check them out, see what you like. And yeah, I mean, you can get through a rock gig playing that big, heavy backbeat. And you said you use a high energy snare drum head.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's good. That's going to last. Great snare drum head.
Oh, High impact is the one I use, the one with the dot underneath, the coated one with the dot underneath. Yeah. It's kind of like an Emperor X. For people that need a comparison, I love it. I love those heads. They last. Yeah, and anything Aquarian lasts. I mean, you know, I've had Aquarians where I've been on the road. And it was dented up, and I'll just take a blow dryer to it and bring the dents out, and it wakes the head up until you need another one, until you can get the opportunity to stop and get one if you don't have enough. You know, I usually bring enough, but I got in that position once with a 16, and I had to use a blow dryer on it, take the bumps out, and ironically it brings back some of the sound. It actually works. I wouldn't advise doing it all the time. But in an emergency situation, it works.
Yeah. I keep a heat gun in my case for that.
Yeah.
They're
great. When I learned that trick, I was like, oh my God, this is phenomenal. Yeah. This is awesome. that one and Velcro under the kick pedal were probably the two most awesome things that have ever happened to me in my drum career.
The two highlights of my career, a blow dryer and Velcro. Hey, there's an album title for you. Blow dryer.
I'm telling you, man. It's so true. I used to have to duct tape my pedal down, my bass drum down. It's like just these mounds of duct tape because it would slide all over. It didn't matter how I angled it, nothing. Tracy says I have a 100-pound foot. So that's kind of how my life for a long time, that was just the bane, me constantly pulling the bass drum back, putting sandbags in front of it, whatever. And then when I learned the Velcro trick, it was like, oh my God, thank you. It totally works. It works.
Yeah, it's killer. What kind of bass drum pedal do you use?
I'm using the Yamaha FP9.
Oh, okay.
Which I like a lot. It's solid. It's a chain drive. I just can't get comfortable with the direct drives yet. I've tried them. I don't know. There's just something that I'm old school and it just doesn't feel right to me. I love the chain drives and I always have. As a matter of fact, here's an interesting story. When I was right when Odin got signed, I had a deal. I just got a deal with DW and, I was one of the five drummers that helped develop the turbo pedal.
Oh, really? And no kidding.
Yeah. What happened is I went down and Don Lombardi was asking me about, he wanted me to try the chain drive pedal that they had. And I was like, you know, they wobble. I can't, you know, and I said, this is what I like. And I had this old Sonar pedal that had a plate underneath it. And I said, this is solid. This doesn't move, you know, blah, blah, blah. And over time I would get pedals sent to me. I still have a couple of the, you know, the patent pending, you know, 5,000s back there, 3,000s, I think they are, 2,000. I can't even remember. Anyway. So there's actually a modern drummer ad. I have it somewhere in my house hanging up and it's me and Frankie Benali and Tommy Lee. Me, Frankie, Tommy, and the drummer for Great White at the time, Gary Holland, on this ad for the new DW pedal. And that was because I was involved in basically, you know, helping them make that pedal.
That is so cool, man. That's got to make you feel good being part of that, you know, of a legacy like that, because everybody plays, you know.
They're great. They're great.
Out of the box and put it on the drum and you just play it. Yeah, great.
Oh yeah, it's on. The FP9s aren't as easy to put on my Tech Rider, and I have DWs on the Tech Rider with the 9000s because. You know, they're going to have them. And again, like you said, they're going to go on the drum and you're going to hit it with your foot. And you're going to be like, fine, this is great.
Yeah.
Feels good. It's got power. I like it.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, you know, Sean, we thank you for coming on the show. We're going to wrap it up. We do about an hour on the show. We want to thank you so much for being part of what we do. And is there anything that you want to plug I know you got the tour and stuff, but do you have an album coming out or a product or anything like that that you would like to plug on your end?
Well, the only thing at the moment would be the tour we have coming up where we're going out with Tom Kiefer, and I leave on the 25th, and I think that goes until mid-August. And that's kind of the, you know, as a matter of fact, next week I'm going to pull all my drums out, change all my heads, you know, go through that and do an inventory of what I might need. And so that's really about it. So LA Guns and Tom Keefe will be out there. I know we're doing some headline shows in there. It's pretty much mostly the Midwest, Michigan, Illinois, and Minnesota and whatnot. So, Very cool. Come out. Sweet. We're going to have some fun.
That's awesome. Very cool. All right. So, guys, if you would, everybody hang on after we go off the air. Everybody stay here for just a minute. Everybody, thank you for watching Drummers Education Connection. Thank you to Sean Duncan for being our guest today and our guest host, Fred Fisher. Thank you for coming on today and filling in for our friend Jeremy Steinkohler that couldn't make it. We will see you guys next week on deck. Rick, play some drums, baby. Play
All right, let's go. We'll be right back.